All right, well, being the last speaker, I'll try to wrap things up so we can get off to lunch. I know I'm starving, so we'll get a move on. I do want to acknowledge my other co-authors on this talk, and it's Mike McLaughlin, Artashur Deli, and Dana Miles. We're all at the USDA ARS location at Mississippi State University. And this is some exciting research that kind of fell into our laps a few years ago. It was just one of those opportunities where you know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, and it just fell into our laps, and it worked out really well. So the title of my talk is Pathogen and Antibiotic-Resistant Bacterial Colonization of Naive Broiler Houses. Now, we've heard a little bit about CAFOs, mostly pig CAFOs, a little bit of dairy discussions, but we're going to go into poultry CAFOs in this case. Give you a little bit of background for those of us that may not know. About 1 in 6 or 48 million Americans are sickened with foodborne pathogens in a given year. The pathogens, the big hitters that we know about are the salmonellas, the campylobacters, E. coli, listerias, and of course noroviruses as well. And part of that, and maybe not necessarily related to that number, those numbers there, are antibiotic-resistant infections. We know there's about 2 million Americans infected with antibiotic-resistant infections. Not necessarily related to that particular number up there, but we do know that that's also a big issue, and that's going to be part of the discussion here. We do know that as far as the poultry industry is concerned, it's a very large industry. Majority of people enjoy their poultry products. Approximately 8.5 billion broilers are produced per year, and it's definitely a large industry. As such, the industry is interested in producing birds on a very fast rate, make these birds fatter, do it in a very faster conditions. We don't want to waste feed these sorts of things. And so one of the things that was done at that time, back in a few years ago, was the use of antibiotics as prophylactics or antibiotics as growth-promoting compounds. But starting around 2009 going forward, and there were a few recommendations and recommendations afterwards, the industry started pulling back on the use of antibiotics, and that was really due to a lot of public scrutiny going from about 2009 on forward. So this particular study fell into our laps where we came into contact with a grower who was getting ready to build a brand new CAFO consisting of 6 houses. He now has 8 houses. And these 6 houses were being built on previously forested land that had nothing of agricultural significance, you know, no crop grown, no anything like that. It was just forested land. So it was really clean environment that we could really watch the development and growth of pathogens and antibiotic resistance over time. So it led to the question, does antibiotic resistance and pathogen presence develop immediately? Is it a 2-year thing? Is it a 1-year thing? Is it a 2-week thing? Is it a 5-year thing? But we want to see this development occur and how quickly does it occur. We do know that in these CAFO conditions, as Terry was talking about earlier, we do know in these CAFO conditions that certainly bacteria will more than readily grow under these conditions. And if anyone knows about the poultry house conditions, the litter, which is a combination of either pine shavings, rice hulls, and fecal matter, it's a condition that is just ripe for growth, and it's definitely ripe for it. Unfortunately, though, many of the studies that we've conducted in these, and some of which are my studies that we've conducted, we've gotten into these poultry houses after they've been established for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, you know, probably about 10 years, 15 years is about the most that I've at least been involved in. But so we don't really get to see on the ground floor. We don't really get to take a look at that very beginning of the process. So this allows us to actually look at that behind the window sort of look, behind the door. So the objectives of this study were to demonstrate the initial colonization of naive broiler houses with common foodborne pathogens, and indicator bacteria, as well as antibiotic resistant bacteria. We also want to determine the spatial and brooding side influence on these particular bacteria and how they colonized depending on where they're at in the poultry houses. And we also, a side project of mine is I like to compare the traditional microbiological approaches, the culturing techniques, compare those that data with what we're getting now with our qPCR data, which is quickly becoming, you know, one of the gold standard approaches. So overall, we had access to 3 out of the 6 houses. So we utilized all 3 houses. As I said, we got in when they were first clearing off the land. So we were able to take soil samples as soon as they erected the houses. We were able to go ahead and take soil samples in there. Now, they had removed the top maybe 18 to 20 inches of topsoil and leveled it. So we were dealing with, you know, surface of Mars stuff. There was just like nothing there. It was rock, it just rock hard. You couldn't even penetrate it with a probe.
Was it red clay or what?
Yes, it was. And we actually had to use a chisel to break through it. It was unbelievable. But anyway, so we were able to get the soil samples at that point. We were also able to get the litter as it was being brought in, the bedding material, in this case, rice hulls. So we were able to get a hold of that before they introduced birds to it. Once they did introduce birds, the density was about 30,000 birds per house, the typical 7.5 week grow out period with 2 weeks layout, all in, all out approaches. As far as sample sites, we collected samples from the wall, the eastern side wall, the watering lines, and the feeder lines, as well as replicating that on the fan side and on the brood side, and I'll show a picture of that in a minute. We did collect from flocks 1 through 11, so that's roughly about 2 years, a little over 2 years worth of collection. And we did this, we collected at the third week of every time of every flock. And of course, we would have liked to have more intensive sampling, but we had other studies going on as well at that point. Here you see, let's see the map, yeah. All right, so here you see the fan end. Here's the brood end of a typical house. And right here where the white arrows are located, that is where we collected samples. This is the eastern sidewall, then followed by the watering line and the feeder line. So we collected these samples here and replicated it on the brood end as well. As far as what we looked for, the culturing approaches, the cultivation approaches, we looked for heterotrophic plate count bacteria, HPCs. It's the generic bacterium. It's aerobic, a group of bacteria that just kind of gives us an idea of the overall microbial quality of a particular matrix. We also looked for staphylococcus or staphylococci, enterococci, E. coli, the big pathogens, salmonella, campylobacter. And from these particular pathogens and some of these indicators, we also subjected them to Kirby-Bauer antibiogram analysis. Approximately 30% of the isolates we subjected that that particular analysis to. And we utilized this particular set of antibiotics, and it was tailor-made to each particular organism or group of organisms. As far as the culture-independent approaches, we extracted DNA in cost, in the interest of limiting our cost. We extracted DNA from the pre-flock environment, and we extracted DNA from the flock 1 and flock 11, so the first and last flock that we were involved in. Once again, we would have liked to have collected, you know, throughout the whole period there, but this was an interest to keep costs down. Quantitative PCR was our assay of choice in this case, and we subjected the DNA to a number of assays, 16S ribosomal RNA, enterococcus gene assays, salmonella, E. coli, listeria, campylobacter, as well as a number of antibiotic resistant gene assays, ARGs, in this case TET-A, ERM-F, INT1, and SOL1, and BLA-TEM. So looking into the soil and the litter, and we're going to start with some of the cultivation and independent approaches. Looking at the soil, basically, as I said, they had stripped off the entire topsoil. So we're really working with very low numbers of HPCs. Typically in a productive agricultural soil in our neck of the woods, we're looking around 10 to the 10, 10 to the 9 CFUs per gram. This is around 10 to the 6. CFUs per gram, so certainly a pretty decent reduction, about 3 to 4 orders of magnitude reduction as a result of removing that topsoil. Staphylococcus was also low, but you can also see here, though, the indicator bacteria that we normally see, of course, were not found in that soil or whatever you want to call it in the poultry houses. Looking at the litter, this is the pre-flock litter. This is using the cultivation-independent approaches, so qPCR. The big thing to look at here is that in this area here, we have no detection of any of our antibiotic resistance genes or Campylobacter. However, and this was a shock to us, and I had our technician run this a few times because I didn't believe it, was the presence of Salmonella DNA in the pre-flock litter. Now, this is just litter that was brought in on a truck, but as Dan was talking about earlier, who knows how dirty or clean these trucks are. It might have been a truck that was used to haul dirty litter at one point and they didn't clean it. We don't know. We're limited on that sort of knowledge. But we did find Salmonella DNA in our pre-flock litter, as well as Enterococcus DNA, E. coli DNA, and Listeria DNA as well. Looking at some of the this table over here, looking at some of the same litter data, this is using cultivation. We also do corroborate some of those results and detect, show that we're detecting E. coli, albeit at a very low amount, but we are detecting E. coli in the pre-flock litter as well as Enterococcus. None of the pathogens were detected in the pre-flock litter as far as culture approaches. So looking at the influence of flock number, so as the flock numbers progress, and you can see that here from flocks 1 through 11 on the x-axis, on the y-axis you have a concentration of bacteria in CFUs per gram. Basically the big thing here is that as soon as we introduce the flock, the first flock within those first few weeks, as soon as we introduced them, the number shot up to about 10 to the 10. CFUs per gram. So we went up about four orders of magnitude for these particular bacteria. For the Staphylococcus, we went up around six orders of magnitude in litter. So we definitely have a big influence as soon as we introduce that flock. Staphylococci levels were certainly high. They approached 10 to the 12 over here around flock 5 and 7. Approached 10 to the 12 CFUs per gram, and this was high particularly for most of the studies and most of the literature that I've seen. This is a particularly high number, and it could be a result of the rice hulls being just a more appropriate bedding material that allowed a proliferation of this group of bacteria. As far as intra-house site, and we've seen this with other studies that we've conducted, there's really not a huge effect between feeders, water lines, and the walls. We do see some effect. There were some statistically significant results here. I don't know if necessarily that they were biologically significant, but there were some significant results there. And of course, we see our typical spikings with certain bacterial groups, such as Clostridium perfringens spiking right there at flock 4, and you can see it at all sites it spiked. And that was the result of just an outbreak of dermatitis in the CAFO. Looking at pathogens, basically the take-home point here that Salmonella was there as soon as our first samples were collected. Once we introduced that flock, Salmonella was there, and it was in every single sample that we collected, which was pretty shocking to me. I went in not expecting that. In fact, we had chose presence-absence tests rather than using like an MPN approach for our cultivation, because I just wasn't expecting Salmonella to be detectable at such high levels, especially when we looked at the litter when we were in these houses. The litter didn't look like it had any fecal matter. I mean, we had little small chicks, and so you had very small amounts of fecal matter every so often, but it looked fairly clean. I would have laid down in it if I had known what it was. I mean, it looked that clean. But Salmonella was present everywhere. Campylobacter, on the other hand, and those of us who culture Campylobacter know that it is a pain, and Campylobacter was not detectable in any of the litter samples throughout any of the flocks, and so that was not exactly a shock there. Sliding over to table 3, this is a synopsis of the Kirby-Bauer analysis. Basically, we're looking at flocks 1 through 11 here, and we're looking at the resistance to one class of antibiotics, resistance to two classes or more of antibiotics, and susceptibility to all the antibiotics tested. Basically, what happened here is approximately the majority of the bacteria were resistant to at least one antibiotic class, which is not a shock. And multi-resistant, for the most part, the proportion stayed about the same throughout the study period. So we didn't see a whole lot of fluctuation there once the flock established itself. Looking a little bit more closely at the effect of intra-house site location, in this case we're looking at feeders with the orange and blue. These bars are the walls, and these are the watering lines. Basically, a few points here is that for the most part, any statistically significant results were related to moisture, and that makes sense. Those of us who work with bacteria know that the bacteria love moisture, and so water lines and the wall lines, the walls would basically take up a lot of condensation from the environment, and so you'd have moist areas there at the walls, whereas you wouldn't necessarily have it in the middle of the house unless it's under a watering line. And so, of course, we expect to find E. coli significantly associated with these locations, and Clostridium perfringens, for that matter, was also significantly associated with the watering lines as well. Our most numerous bacteria and bacterial groups, HPCs and the Staphylococcus cocci, they were not associated with anything. They were just ubiquitously found throughout the environment, regardless of sample site location. Looking at some of the cultivation-independent approaches, the qPCR data, what we got here is flock 1 and flock 11 data. Along the x-axis is the different analyses, 16S, Enterococcus, E. coli, Salmonella, Listeria, and Campylobacter. And on the y-axis, you have your concentrations in genomic units per gram. And remember, this is a qPCR approach. Basically, what we see here is that, similar to the cultivation data, as soon as we introduce the flock, we have a large spike of bacteria. And of course, that was reflected in our genomic approaches, our DNA-based approaches. We see a large spike in numbers, about 4 to 6 orders of magnitude. And in some cases, a lot of these were below detection limit in the pre-flock litter. And as soon as we introduced that flock, they had jumped up to 6 to 8 orders of magnitude. So we don't see big differences between flock 1 and flock 11. So basically, once it established, it established. And that was that. One thing we do notice is the Salmonella. Now, Salmonella DNA was detectable, readily detectable in our sample. However, what was interesting is that it wasn't detectable in every sample, not like the cultivation approaches. And this is not terribly shocking, given SPOQ issues and also given issues associated with detection limits and whatnot. Campylobacter, on the other hand, we did detect Campylobacter DNA in our samples, whereas we did not detect it via cultivation. So we do have some discrepancies there. Looking at the antibiotic resistant gene level, basically same story. As soon as we introduced the flock, the levels shot through the roof. Everything was readily detectable. Remember, the pre-flock litter did not have detectable levels of antibiotic resistant genes. As soon as we put the flock in, boom, went up. And same thing for the soil, no detectable levels of antibiotic resistance. So basically, our discussion points, we're looking at, there was little to no resistance or pathogen levels in soil, pre-flock, or pre-flock litter. As soon as we introduced that flock, the levels just shot through the roof. According to our farmer, no antibiotics were used for prophylactics or for growth promotion. We're going by hearsay, you know, not hearsay, but we're going by that's what he or she tells us. We just have to go by that. Understanding that working with the poultry industry, obviously sometimes it's a black box and you don't know what's going on because they don't necessarily tell us. Maybe they just don't tell me. But that's one of the things that we are dealing with in this case. It does suggest that the resistance occurred as soon as that flock was introduced. So it could be that the resistance or the pathogens are coming tagging along with those particular birds, or it could be an insect thing. Now that we're in this insect discussion, could be related to insects. Resistance and pathogen levels did move quickly and did colonize quickly throughout the house. Rice hulls appeared to really proliferate and enrich bacteria. And cultivation versus cultivation independent approaches. They didn't corroborate. And this, you know, I'm beginning to see this as a trend more often than not, that they don't necessarily corroborate one another. So in our conclusions, basically, it seems like it's going to be difficult to prevent antibiotic resistance and pathogens from colonizing CAFOs. This is one of the few studies that I know of where we're getting in on a virgin CAFO, on a naive CAFO, and watching this development happen. Normally we already see it fully developed, but now we get to see true anthropogenic influence on an environment and watch this development occur. Same thing for the pathogens. One thing I want to say though is keep in mind it's difficult to extrapolate a lot of these results. This is only 3 houses out of 6 on one CAFO in one state. This is not necessarily something that we can say applies to everybody in every state. So it limits our extrapolation of the data. And with that, I'm done, and let's go to lunch.
I have a question. How soon did the beetles show up?
As soon as those birds were there.
First flock.
They were there. And, you know, we didn't see there was not one beetle prior to. In fact, like I said, it was the surface of Mars. There was nothing in that house. As soon as those birds were there, the beetles were crawling through the walls, and it just progressively got worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. So I want to thank Kim, who had the idea for this symposium, and all of our speakers.